Las Vegas Hits the Skids, a medical horror story in Guatemala. Stem cells are back in the news, taking a tally of the rallies in D.C., and why teenagers just don't seem to grow up. It's Monday, October 4, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The city of Las Vegas is in trouble. The New York Times on Sunday reported that the region is facing its deepest slide since the 1940s. As a matter of fact, a look at the data indicates that Las Vegas may be looking at its poorest economic forecast since the creation of the city as a major mecca for gambling and entertainment back in the 1950s and 60s. Adam Nagorny, reporting for the New York Times, indicates that the depth of this economic depression in Las Vegas has led to an unemployment figure that has skyrocketed to 14.7%. What has happened in terms of the collapse of Las Vegas is not just about gambling, although gambling is clearly driving the energy that is dragging the economy down. Construction has been a major factor in Las Vegas in terms of employment and commercial activity, and that has basically come to a standstill. Some casinos are now being shuttered, and other media are reporting that casinos, of all things, are now considering getting into internet gambling, even as they're facilitating that within the casino buildings themselves. The interesting thing about this particular story is that gambling has become something of a depressed business. Now, as the New York Times explains, those who have experienced significant economic loss, and in particular those such as baby boomers who have experienced a significant loss in retirement savings, are disinclined to gamble, of all things. Imagine that. It also turns out that in a time of economic confusion, people tend to hold on to their money. They're less likely to gamble it in games of chance. So the casinos and the various tables of games and slot machines in Las Vegas and elsewhere, but Las Vegas in particular, are standing idly by. The money simply isn't there. Now, one of the interesting facets of this story is that it turns out that people, despite all of their confusions and inclinations, tend in a time of economic recession actually to behave differently than they do otherwise. Which is to say that gambling, as it turns out in a shadow image here, it turns out that gambling is something that people do largely when they think they can't afford to do so. Of course, that betrays the fact that no one actually can afford to waste money and lose money, and gambling is built on such a false premise. Well, literally, the odds are stacked against you. They're always in favor of the house. But when the business begins to slow, the house also begins to suffer. Another interesting aspect of all this, of course, is that persons who have experienced economic loss, by and large, aren't about to gamble to try to get their money back. The gaming industry is trying to figure out new ways to get people in the casinos and new ways to get people parted from their money. But there's another aspect of this story which is also of great interest. States and other governments tend to make a good deal of money by taxing and putting all kinds of fees and licensing into the business flow of gambling. States themselves often operate as gambling houses as they sponsor lotteries. The reality is that gambling preys upon those who are least able to gamble their money away. Many of the people who are now found in the casinos are those who actually are the least likely to be able to afford to lose this kind of money. They're not the middle class and wealthy people who are now staying away because they're holding on to their money. It is those who are in the poorer cohorts of the society who, by and large, find their way now onto the gambling boats, into the casinos, and into the places where lottery tickets are sold. This puts the society as a whole, and certainly government most particularly, in the position of preying on its own citizens. And, in terms of perverse incentives, the states now have to hope that the gambling revenues increase so that their own tax coffers can be refilled. So expect it will not only be the casinos that are looking for increased business, but states offering lotteries as well. Over the weekend, news came out of Guatemala that is nothing less than chilling. It turns out that the United States infected about 700 Guatemalans with venereal diseases between the years of 1946 and 1948. As Donald G. McNeil Jr. reports, American tax dollars paid for these medical experiments in which 700 Guatemalans, largely prison inmates, mental patients, and soldiers, were infected with venereal diseases in what was meant to be an effort to test the effectiveness of penicillin. This is a hard truth that Americans need to face squarely. As Susan Reverby, a professor at Wellesley College who uncovered this particular story, has revealed, American medical authorities intentionally infected this large number, several hundred Guatemalans, with these diseases just in order to test penicillin. Now, there are several interesting aspects to this story. For one thing, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had to apologize to the Guatemalan government and acknowledge that this macabre and horrifying medical experiment had taken place. This, of course, brings back memories of another incident where the United States, in terms of our own medical authorities, infected some at Tuskegee Institute with a similar disease in order also to do medical testing. But there's something else lurking in the background of this story. During World War II, we now know that the Nazis conducted horrifying medical experiments, inflicting certain populations with diseases and infirmities, chilling them and freezing them, and doing all kinds of horrifying experiments, including gruesome surgeries on twins, all of this in the name of medical science. The name of Dr. Joseph Mengele, in terms of the Nazi medical experiments, will go down in medical history and in the history of medical ethics as one of the most heinous of all names. But now we know that the Germans, and indeed the Nazis, were not the only persons in the mid-decades of the 20th century who were engaged in these kind of experiments. The Nazi regime was indeed not the only government. As the New York Times reports, the U.S. government was even paying for prostitutes to infect these Guatemalans with venereal diseases, compounding our complicity with medical ethical violations with many other moral violations as well. Now, the thing to note here, whether it is the German Nazi medical experiments or these conducted by American doctors in Guatemala, the issue is that this was done in the name of medical science. The doctors who were performing these experiments no doubt did so because they would claim that they were advancing medicine. They were learning and testing the efficacy of penicillin as an antibiotic. We should all be thankful for penicillin. We should be thankful that the scientists did determine that penicillin was safe, and they learned by experimentation how to use it. But the unethical violation of the bodily integrity of these Guatemalans, using foreign persons and indeed persons without defense within Guatemala, is another sign that there is, in medicine, a drive to get answers to questions that will lead some persons to unethical extremes in order to gain the data. We know this when we look at the case of the Nazi medical experiments. But we now know this when we look at the case of American doctors in Guatemala. It is not the case that anything, whatever its moral cost, is legitimate if we can point to a medical gain. A medical gain at a tremendous and unconscionable moral loss is a net loss. A similar story in USA Today raises many of the same issues. Dan Vergano reports that there is a new method that now makes adult stem cells act like human embryonic stem cells. As I read from his account, stem cell researchers on Thursday reported a new method for reprogramming adult cells into ones that act more like versatile embryonic stem cells, an advance that could open a new avenue for lab-grown transplant tissues. Now, this is undeniable good news. Any technology that allows for human stem cells, adult stem cells, to be transformed into pluripotent cells that could be used for medical experimentation, this is good news. There is absolutely no ethical complication with the use of adult human stem cells. They are derived without any injury to the human being and certainly without any destruction of the embryo. But so many are now insisting on using stem cells that are drawn from the human embryo, which means that the embryo must be destroyed. Just last week, a federal appeals court put a stay on a lower court decision that had halted many of the experiments that were conducted under the new rules set in place by the Obama administration. The Obama administration several months ago liberalized the rules and guidelines that had been put into place by former President George W. Bush. Now what we face is an ongoing battle in Congress to define what will and will not be paid for by our federal tax dollars when it comes to human stem cell research. Now, something to watch here is the response of the medical community to this good news as reported in a scientific journal and now also in media such as USA Today. The response of the medical community to this new innovation is going to be interesting because, oddly enough, the response of so many stem cell researchers has been to dismiss all of these technologies, not because they might not work, but because they absolutely insist that they must work with human embryonic stem cells, regardless of the fact that a human embryo is destroyed in the process. That means it's really not about medical science. It's about drawing a line in the sand and refusing to allow the sanctity of human life to be considered as an important moral factor. If it were, that important moral factor would apply to issues far beyond stem cell research. And that's why you see so much opposition. The rally held this past weekend on the Mall in Washington, D.C. was intended, at least in part, as an answer to the massive crowd that had gone to hear Glenn Beck and other speakers just a few weeks ago. What we had here was something of an opposing set of rallies, with this more liberal rally, indeed a clearly liberal rally, as an answer to what was perceived as a more conservative rally with Glenn Beck and others. Now, already we've discussed the fact that this was a motley crew of liberal groups. Not only was it the NAACP and the AFL-CIO, also involved in this particular group were Marxist and communist groups, the Communist Party USA, the United Church of Christ, Jewish Funds for Justice, the National Urban League, People for the American Way, and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Now, note also that the United Methodist Church was listed here. It's interesting as you look at this particular kind of rally that what we have are opposing forces, and we have some very odd company here with a denomination such as the United Methodist Church, which has indeed taken very liberal positions at times, but has now, by its involvement in this march, set itself against many of its own members. But what's going on in the media is that there's a constant going back and forth between these rallies in order to argue which side has the advantage and the momentum in this cultural conflict. The reality is, however, that there's very little tie between no matter how many people turn up at a rally in Washington and how many actually turn out to vote. The motivations are very different, the media opportunities are incredibly different, and the reality is that even though the first rally, the more conservative one, appears vastly to have outnumbered the second rally, there are more rallies to come. The media are sure to give these attention. Another interesting factor that's an innovation is that people in the media are now taking such an important vocal role, whether it's Ed Schultz at the Progressive Liberal meeting this past weekend or Glenn Beck and others in earlier events. This much is clear. The future of our culture is really not established by any rally in Washington, no matter its numbers. The issues that matter come down to how many people actually turn out to vote. Writing in World Magazine, Jeannie Cheney reports on a story in USA Today that comes off of a report from the Barna Research Group. "Bye-bye, church, we're busy," she writes. That's the message teens are giving churches today. The article in USA Today then goes on to report that only 1 in 4 teens now participates in church youth groups, and declining numbers engage in Christian behaviors like prayer, Bible reading, witnessing, and church attendance. Well, this is news, and it is interesting. And Jeannie Cheney's right to point to this data. The youth evangelism movement of the 1960s and 70s continued in momentum well into the 80s and 90s. But it is striking now that only 1 out of 4 young people is now involved as a teenager in a church youth group. That is a dramatic change from a period of just a few years ago. Now, one of the things that is going on here is, of course, a rethinking of youth ministry in many churches. But Jeannie Cheney says this might be less about youth ministry than about youth. Let me read you this paragraph from her article. "If kids are losing interest, the problem may be less in the idea of youth group than in the idea of what it means to be a teenager. It used to mean taking on adult responsibilities and expectation of marriage and family. But by mid-20th century, a culture of unprecedented wealth and leisure created a holding pen for teenagers called adolescence, carefree years that parents fondly expected would be the time of their children's lives. Instead, idleness without a focus has produced teen angst, a modern construct that makes less sense the more you think about it. At a time of peak energy, optimum learning ability, and fresh enthusiasm, why are so many teens listless, bored, and jaded? Gen X adults remember those years as a viper pit of peer pressures and identity crises, and hormones, of course. Then they write books and produce music to reinforce that view, which makes the kids even more depressed, end quote. Which is another way of saying maybe one of the problems about teenagers that won't grow up are, well, let's just face it, parents who won't grow up and are thus very little help in getting their teenagers to grow up. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com, where you will find a wealth of resources there and available for you. You can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. In particular, look at information about Southern Seminary Preview Day to be held on October the 15th. It's your quintessential opportunity to come visit the campus. We are glad to have you visit anytime. But October the 15th, Preview Day, affords the unprecedented opportunity to be in the presence of many others who, like yourself, are considering God's call in their lives and what they should do about seminary. We'd love to have you as our guest. For more information, go to sbts.edu. For the last few days, I've been in Minneapolis, Minnesota for the Desiring God Ministries National Conference. I've been here with my dear friend, Dr. John Piper, and several others as well. I have been amazed by the thousands of young people who come to this conference, and once again, my heart is just tremendously warmed by being in the company of so many committed young people who come with such enthusiasm for the fame of Christ's name. So, even as we look at the many, many young people who aren't growing up and don't appear to be doing much, let's be thankful for those who are growing up and getting busy, doing something great for the cause of Christ. Thanks for listening. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.